The following presentation is brought to you by The Realm Network.
The Bob Seska Show, presented by BubbleGenius.com.
Broadcasting from Resistance Headquarters,
relentlessly fighting back against the clown dictator and his regime of deplorables.
Never give up, never surrender.
This is The Bob Seska Show, presented by BubbleGenius.com.
From our nation's capital, it is Monday, October 22, 2018, and this is the Bob Seska Show, interviews from Earth One. My guest today is a personal hero of mine, the great Tony Atamanik. He's hands down the smartest and funniest Trump impressionist working today. His special, The Fall of Donald Trump, airs tonight at 11 p.m. Eastern on Comedy Central. Check your local listings or set your DVRs. Plus, Tony has a book dropping tomorrow called American Tantrum, The Donald J. Trump Presidential Archives. I've been a fan of Tony's work ever since the primaries when he toured with the great James Adomian as Bernie Sanders. And in case you haven't seen The President Show, you have to go to YouTube and watch a piece called It's a Tremendous Life. It is utter genius. Okay, let's talk to Tony Atamanik on the show today.
Hello.
Tony, it's Bob Seska. How are you?
Bob, how are you? I'm doing great.
Outstanding. Okay, look, I just got to ask. We're going to dig in right now. You were on the Stern Show this morning. Your special comes out tonight. Your book, American Tantrum, The Donald J. Trump Presidential Archives, comes out tomorrow. What is running through your head right now, Tony?
I want sleep. That's what's running through my head. I will say this, as fortunate and happy as I am, I didn't realize the publicity run when you have two things at the same time.
So
it's been talking a lot of Trump and politics, but it's been fantastic. I mean, I'm thrilled to, at a minimum, what I'm thrilled by is the opportunity to, I think, put a unique political perspective out there that maybe is a little more joining and also at the same time stays in the space of being radically American and put that out through comedy and satire. And I think that that's a unique opportunity.
Yeah.
So that's what I'm most pleased by.
Are you in full makeup and costume right now?
No, but I was this morning for Howard.
That's what I saw. That's what I was wondering.
Only Howard could get me to dress up at 5 in the morning.
That's right. I can't even imagine. Like, what, when you take all of that gear off, do you have to wring it out? I mean, how saturated? Yes. I mean, how, because I mean, I tend to be a sweaty guy just when I'm wearing regular clothes. I can't even imagine putting on all of that. Plus, you have like a coolant system in there, don't you?
Yes. Well, I'll tell you. Yeah. So, the first thing is we have a vest with water, cold water that runs through it that I put underneath the fat suit, and it's connected to what looks like a dialysis machine. And I used to have to explain to the audience during the live show, I'd have to be like, I'm not like sick. It's just like a cooling unit. Yeah. I would still sweat because I also like to dance in between. When we were doing the live show, you know, you'd have to do the resetting the set.
Uh-huh.
So I would dance, you know, to like, you know, Elton John or ABBA or whatever for the audience because I thought it would be so surreal to see Trump, you know, boogieing.
Yeah.
And I have a ball cap on. And so we learned very early on to put a vent in the back of the ball cap, because one time before we put the vent in, I had done a whole show and I went to pull the ball cap off from the back of my head. And as I pulled out the back, a rush of warm water, I mean, like someone dumped a full gallon of water down my back.
Jesus.
And I'm a sweaty Italian. So,
yeah, me too.
It's a brutal experience.
Oh God, yeah. Well, let's talk about the show tonight. Fall of Donald Trump. It looks like it's going to be slightly different than a normal president show. Speaking of the format that you established, it's more of a mockumentary, right? Going all filmed segments, which is different. Yeah,
it's an interesting experience. The first season of the show, we, you know, had this take of him doing these fireside chats in sort of the style of a Johnny Carson, and Comedy Central readily picked that up.
Yeah.
And then we noticed within it that, you know, we would do these field pieces. And so we'd do sort of, you know, at the start, we maybe did like a few more traditional sort of, you know, almost daily, not daily show style, but in the style of, you know, field digital cameras, sort of man in the street stuff. And I, you know, went to film school and so on, and I was like, I have a TV show, so maybe I should try to do some short films while we're at it. And so our first one, I think, was Trump Trips, was the first fully filmed piece we did that was shot on, you know, anamorphic lenses and so on.
Yeah.
And we started to do more of those. You know, we did the mob one. We did the alternate universe Trump. And so as we evolved the show over the season, we were making more and more of these short films, mm-hmm. and they were always some of the best work. I mean, the whole show was wonderful. They were some of the best, most sort of, standing on their 2 feet pieces.
Oh, yeah.
And so after the April special, which was the live telethon with a couple of field pieces in it, it was more difficult to relaunch a live show just for one day, you know? And so because of the special sort of format that we're in right now with Comedy Central, when we went into the next special, I considered, what if we did a narrative piece? And since we've had such success with Mueller Man and all these different pieces, why don't we go into that place? And then I wanted to look at what would feel comprehensive and big. And I had been watching a lot of the History Channel Hunt for Hitler stuff, you know, which is on forever.
Yeah.
But there's that special about whether he went to Argentina and all that. And mm-hmm. I said, you know, Trump is going to be this someday, you know, in 20 years, 10 years, 12 years in this case, in 2030, there is going to be this look back at like the terror time, the terrible time of this era.
Yeah.
And I thought, why don't we look at it from that lens? And that gives us epicness. It gives us an opportunity to make it feel large, to make it move through time. And we can make some satirical points that hit not at just Trump, but hit at the system at large, the electoral system, the you know, what is the real Russian design in terms, or, you know, in Chinese design of disrupting our elections? Is it so much about supporting Trump, or is it about sowing chaos and democracy? And, we wanted to have an opportunity to also showcase, you know, Kathy Griffin, Mario Cantone, Stephanie March, John Kemberling, Peter Gross, Austin Pendleton, all these incredible actors who were working in our show. And I wanted it to be a tribute to all the people who had worked on it. And I think it also, in some ways, I think when people watch the special, there is a transitory property to it that we have elements of our old show that sort of show up throughout it.
Yeah.
And it's sort of saying that we are moving away from that, and we're moving into these more long form narrative, deep dive, psychological pieces, hopefully, if we, you know, continue with Comedy Central.
Yeah. And those were absolutely, I mean, the whole show, I think the whole show is genius. I go back to the original episode with Keith Olbermann, and then on through that first season and then the second season. And, you know, I love all the desk pieces, and but it's the filmed pieces, the field pieces to me that really stood out as being the most salient comments on Donald Trump, not only as a personality, but as a politician. And then, I'd love to talk about some of my favorite field pieces here in just a second. But I'm so glad to hear that you've got the band back together for tonight's special. Do we get to hear John Gemberling's angelic singing voice again as Steve Bannon?
You know, there's no singing in. Oh, there. That's a lie. There is singing, but John does not sing.
Oh, that's John too bad. That's too bad.
The Christmas special I think everyone involved in the Christmas special will always remember that as a unique moment in I think history. When the Trump administration, you know, the first Christmas under Trump, and then also I think just. In general, I think because it was such a tight group and it was such a Broadway, it was such a New York show, you know, with Bebe Neuwirth and all that.
Oh, absolutely. And of course you brought in, we just dive into some of your field pieces here. I mean, with that particular special, with the Christmas special, one of my favorite field pieces was actually introduced partly by James Adomian as Bernie, and it's just an unbelievably brilliant Bernie. And I want to talk about your impression, and I want to talk about James Adomian's impression, which you guys both developed at the same time here in just a second. But you did a piece in the Christmas special called "It's a Tremendous Life," and it's so utterly insightful on every level. Trump without Fred's money as a bungling street hustler. And then just less than a year later, we get further hard news confirming that Trump's entire fortune was built on Fred's money. Take us through the process of creating that film. It's really perhaps the best piece of Trump satire in existence, I think.
Well, thank you. I think So the process of developing that idea was, you know, we were vetting the Christmas special, and I had said for a long time that, you know, Trump would have just been a shell game guy. Like, he's just a guy from Queens. I mean, right. That's the thing, is all he is really is a guy from Queens.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not an insult. I'm from Queens. Like, I mean, I'm not born and raised, but I'm, you know, I live in Queens now and have lived there for 18 years. And, you know, I know these guys in my neighborhood, you know, yeah. They're like, they're the ones who say I could have been president if they only listened to me. This sort of type of guy, this sort yeah. of Willie Loman, but a little more, you know, sort of aggro. So I had always said that throughout the show. And when we got to the Christmas special, I said, what if we do it? Let's do I'd always wanted to do, remember Marvel Comics, The Watcher?
Oh, yeah.
So I initially wanted a watcher, which mm-hmm. became Bernie, which was, let's see what would happen if you didn't have money. And I had actually pitched it a few times prior to the Christmas special, but it fit most in the Christmas special. So we just found a great place in Queens to film, and we were lucky to get Kathy and Jimmy. And then I wanted it to feel, you know, I kind of wanted it to have a Taxi Driver feel to it. I wanted yeah. it to feel empty, and I really wanted this sort of mix of Taxi Driver and Midnight Cowboy, and
yeah.
You know, that way the original draft, which was going to be shot in a far more confined space than what we ended up doing,
mm-hmm.
had Pence as sort of an Indiana like rent boy
yeah.
who was living in and. And we shifted away from that for a couple of reasons and decided to make it more of a religious con man because
yeah.
We just felt it might be also sort of disrespectful just in general to portray it that way. And not to him, but I mean to the LGBT community.
Right, right.
And so we settled on this sort of idea of a little bit of just a snapshot of different parts of his life. And what we did was we just took the things that we knew were true about him now and put them through the filter of what would it look like without the money. And yeah. it fell right into a very real character. And I think it's one of the few pieces probably done on a Christmas special ever that really ends on a down note. It ends on a sad down note of this pervert crying in the back of a police car, this mm. hustler, this, you know, and it's just another day. And you know, when that ends, 2 days later, when he gets out of, you know, holding, he'll go right back in and repeat yeah. everything again. And to me, that was the most telling part of that piece.
Is it gratifying or terrifying to be that close to the mark where you put together a piece like that and then several months later it actually happens? And this has happened a bunch of times with the president yeah. show, where you'll do a bit and then it'll suddenly happen in real life, like, I'm the president, can you believe it? So things like that, when you see that happen, first of all, I would imagine your instinct is to shout it from a mountaintop, look, we called it. But I mean, internally, yeah. are you thinking, wow, this is great that I was so close, or wow, this is horrible that I was so close?
I mean, I would never think, wow, this is horrible, I guess, in the sense that, like, if you know it, that it's true about him,
yeah.
it's already disappointing from the get-go, so you're mm-hmm. not going to be more surprised when it's true. I think that, I definitely want to scream it from the mountaintops, but, you know, I mean, somewhat, of course, for the pride in our show, but also just, for me, I think, you know, and especially lately appearing on, you know, Morning Joe and a couple of these news programs, is trying to get out to the sort of echo chamber, like, we need to stop a lot of this sort of, for whatever reason, sort of false speculating and tea leaf reading we're doing with him, and
mm-hmm.
and spend a little more time admitting that he's just kind of a broken record of very simple choices, and
yeah.
and that those simple choices will keep spiraling into, unfortunately, some dangerous choice that could put all of us at risk.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think that worrying about is, you know, taking Obama's jobs initiative or doing whatever is, like, you know, those things are terrible for society. But I think that what we have to keep our eye on the prize is that this is a person who can, not through even his own volition. Like, mm-hmm. I think Trump's such a coward. I don't think he would ever launch a nuke. I don't even think he'd want to go to war. I think he's a total yeah. coward. And I don't mean coward like we should go to war, but I mean, he is not a person who is, he talks tough and he doesn't actually mean it.
Yeah, so, he doesn't even like to fire people. I mean, amazingly.
Yeah, he doesn't even like to fire someone. He yeah. wants someone else to do it. But yeah. my fear is that what he will do is set off a chain of events that will open the door to something else happening threatening to us.
Yeah.
And I am very concerned, especially if it's a domestic event, that that will change everything. And I think that the thing that we don't get about what's going on, and it's been broadcast for decades, and we don't want to admit it. It's sort of like you were abused by a parent and you just can't acknowledge it, is that, and it's sort of complex, which is threefold. There's a Jonestowning of America going on with Trump. There's a specific cult that follows him, and this cult is growing, and he is a cult leader. And the worst part is he's a cult leader without even any design.
Oh, yeah.
He's just sort of inherently one. Mm-hmm. But then the second thing is this sort of two-tier. There is the Republican Party specifically, which is desires to destroy every element of democracy and reform it in the shape of an autocratic rule that gives privilege to few and subjugates the rest. Yeah. But the Democratic Party also participates in this system, and they like to position themselves as the saviors, while when they get into power, they end up actually negotiating it away, most of the same things that the Republicans are trying to take away.
Yeah.
So we have this sort of protracted circumstance by which all of it is run by foreign money and corporate money pouring into the United States, dissolving the power of the nation state. And there is no savior. We have no sort of ideology that we can hang our hat on and say, this is the path out of this nightmare.
Yeah.
And I think that that hopefully the message of the special sort of communicates this, which is that it's not like you can run over to the Chuck Schumers and the Nancy Pelosi's of the world and go, well, I know we'll be taken care of here, because they participate in getting donors from, you know, payday loan companies and companies that shortchange African Americans and women, people of poor people and people of color all the time too, right? And it's not to say they're equal. It's not saying all sides, but it's saying you have two corporatized parties that do not answer to the people.
Yeah.
And they play a game where they want you to have an allegiance. And what we need to have is a la carte government. We need to have the opportunity for people to not have the power of the purse being controlled by the party, so that the candidates then feel the need to only reinforce the platform that the party puts forward. Yeah. You want to have independent thinkers who can say, well, how is our welfare system or our Medicare system or our Social Security system set up and designed? You know, the same way our high schools are 19th century. You know, it's not to say let's put our Social Security money in a private fund, but it is to say, like, well, how is it most effectively spent? Should people be able to borrow against it? Should, you know, should you be able to, you know, if you pay into unemployment, you know, should there be a federal tax relief for getting your unemployment money back, so you're not paying taxes on top of the money that was taxed to take you away?
Mm-hmm.
Those are not particularly liberal ideas. They're actually conservative ideas, right?
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, if you put in there the Rooseveltian idea of, you know, we call it socialism, but it's Americanism, which is that if we also build in guarantees where we say, hey, you know, there's a GI Bill, you go to college, you do this, you're going to get health care. Oh, you didn't serve? Well, here's four ways that you could do work for, whether it's some extension of the Pentagon or the federal government in terms of inner city relief or Teach for America for 2 years. You also get this benefit. And, you know, guaranteeing Americans a certain basic right to have housing, a basic right to have minimal electricity, like things that make people's lives better, raising the, you know, damn the corporations, raise the minimum wage to relate to the cost of living. And again, another Democratic problem, stop fostering and reinforcing corporations that are paying people $4.25 an hour to pick melons, which is why they're trying to run across the border, because people are goading them to come here. And the reason I say all these things is not to be like I'm some Trumper or what. That's not what I believe at all. I'm a lefty leftist. But my problem is that in our own party, at least the party I belong to, so I can vote in primaries, we're so scared of Republicans taking us apart that we will pretend to the end of the day that we're perfect and there's nothing we need to fix. And that's not true.
Right.
The Democratic Party also reinforces the culture of white supremacy. The Democratic Party also hides sexual predators in its midst. It is not about scoring one for another team or the other. And I'm afraid that we haven't done the wholesale reflection that we have to do on our side. so that we can be really impenetrable and have candidates that we can believe in and that we actually align with and not settle for.
Yeah.
And I think that's the most probably unpopular part of the tour when I toured with James was when, as Trump, I would speak some truths to the audience that they didn't want to hear. Because I'll tell you, a white liberal in Cambridge, Massachusetts, does not want to know that they participate in the system of inherent white supremacy in the United States, but they do because they live in Cambridge, and Cambridge was partially built on the money of slave labor. And so you need to acknowledge your responsibility, not walk away from it. That's how you heal. And I think that that's my fear on the left. Mm-hmm. On the right, it's pretty obvious. They're basically, you know, whatever they say we are, you know, they are tenfold. So if they say, you know, what's the new Dinesh D'Souza thing is the Democrats are really the party of the Klan and all this because they're using history from 100 years ago. Well, that's only because they are openly courting white supremacists now and not courting them, aligned with them, and have been aligned with them for decades.
Yeah.
And so, you know, anyway, I think it's so complex and convoluted that it's impossible to say, yes, there's good guys and bad guys. But within that sorting process, the one thing we know is that Trump, who is the symptom of this terrible problem, because he's done only everything that the Republican Party wanted to do, but his danger is the fact that he could set off a series of events that could be civilizational ending. And I think that's the most concerning thing. Everyone should have that on their mind.
Yeah.
That he's dangerous. You got to get him out.
Yeah. And it seems like his biggest accomplishment, and in a terrible, terrible way, is the fact that he sucked the air all out of the room. I mean, it's almost impossible to focus on things like you were just talking about when Donald Trump is in our faces 24/7. I mean, the giant orange head in our living rooms around the clock. And it's got to be to the point now where I would imagine, and maybe this is going to be seen in the consequences of the midterms, is that the Trump fatigue has to be setting in at some point. I can't imagine him with this level of visibility being able to continue at that level in perpetuity. I see people just getting utterly sick of him. I mean, it happens most of the time with tabloid celebrities anyway, unless they're able to keep their faces on the front pages. But I've noticed the Inquirer hasn't done a single political cover, single Trump cover ever since Pecker got pinched. So fortunately,
well, I think there's also sort of again, there's like multiple tiers of media. You have you have the social media environment, which covers about maybe, I think it's like 2% of the American, or 10% of the American population actually has some sort of participation in Twitter, and maybe it's like 25% of on Facebook, and Instagram is probably lower than that. So you have that world, which is sort of this vitriol and, you know, a hiding place for white supremacy and conspiracy theories. It's unchecked. It's unregulated. And, you know, the new oil, I mean, you want to talk about who the new villains are, is they're not ExxonMobil. They are the major social media giants, Google, Facebook, Twitter, who are all running around unregulated, poisoning something even worse than the atmosphere, which is your psyche.
Yep.
And so something needs to be done about them, because they are a rapidly declining civilization and also disturbing our intellectual and spiritual growth. You know, so there's that media source, which makes it feel pronounced if you're on there. Now, on cable news, you know, cable news viewership is, again, a very small population of Americans, okay, see that, right? So even with all of that information, most Americans still get their news from a paper or from network news or from what they see on Facebook. That's like literally how most people get their information. So people are seeking it out, or they're not seeking it out, and they're just ignoring it, and they're just a fan of Trump the way you're the fan of the Patriots. And but the problem on the cable news front is, again, you need a firewall between corporate ownership of media companies, and you need to create, again, loss leaders for news.
Yep.
If MSNBC did not have to worry about driving a profit, you could still have your two or three sort of opinion shows, but you'd have now, you know, 18 hours or 10 hours of that day to program frontline style documentaries focusing on these specific issues, having a global news hour, having an opportunity to have an hour that is dedicated every week to civics that you turn in, and you can tune in and learn how to vote, where your polling place is, you know, all these things that should be very not just readily available, but publicly informational.
Yeah.
And those things only happen when you don't have profit-driven news. But profit-driven news, therefore, is captained by, let's face it, the most ignorant people, the most navel-gazing idiots in the world, which are television executives.
Right.
You know, these are not people who care about anything other than finding out what's cool or what's interesting or what's the thing that drives revenue.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that means shifting ourselves, which we need to do, from a fear-based consumerist economy that's driven by our attention. And I'm a participant in it. I have an Xbox and I have a phone and I have all those things. I am not some, you know, ascetic monk who is stepping aside and looking at it from above. But I think it's more important to have that message in a way come from someone who participates in it, which is, how do I either use these devices in a good way? How do I step away from them more? You know, how do I have a healthy relationship with my consumption, right? And also at the same time, not use my consumption as a distraction from what's going on in our society. And I think that those are the big philosophical questions we have to answer in partnership with how do we change our society to have it be more pleasant for everyone, more opportunity for everyone. And listen, I'm from an immigrant family in Boston, Chelsea, Massachusetts, and I'm the first person to believe that the dignity of work is the most important thing, that you should have a job, that you should do something for a living. You shouldn't just be getting shit handed to you. But nobody actually wants that. That's a fiction. This handout thing is a fiction, right? So what we need to do is just look at how do we integrate our society in a way where we know that we're elevating people not within just the idea of the white paradigm, of the white male paradigm of what we need to fix.
Right.
But how do we step outside of that? And part of the way is getting more leadership of color, more women and women of color into, and LGBT into our governmental systems so that we have a better representation of how our society works and operates and get that reflected in our policies.
You know, it's fascinating, Tony, because I just spoke to the great writer, director, Larry Charles, a few weeks ago on the show.
Yeah.
And one of the compliments that I paid to him that I'm going to pay to you is not one that I throw around easily, which is that the work that you guys are doing is so amazingly subversive. The fact that you're able to incorporate a lot of the ideas you were just talking about into a half an hour of Trump satire is an amazing feat, especially on a network like Comedy Central, where it's generally very light. I mean, with the exception of The Daily Show and Colbert back in his day on that network.
Yeah.
We're able to do. It's an incredible thing to see you weave all of these things together and still make it funny and still make it entertaining. And to know that there is this show out there that is doing that, that is able to subvert an entire network, to subvert the powerful entity that is, in a way, Viacom. And it's kind of an amazing thing to see all of that. Plus, you're weaving in Trump as well. How difficult is it to nail that sort of Colbert-esque balancing act between doing a character and then also weaving in the commentary?
I mean, I think that it's like, it's paper mache. I mean, you sort of start with a layer and in our writing process, you know, we would start in the day and during the show and talk about, and even during the special, I use the iceberg theory, which we're going to take an iceberg, we're going to build it, then we're going to sink it in the ocean and only see the tip. And the idea being that if you layer it properly and bury it properly, then you should come off not looking preachy, but looking like you have a message.
Yeah.
And I think the key always was that we weren't going to, in the live show, we weren't going to trade on sexist and racist tropes, even though Trump is a sexist and racist. We weren't going to use those as an excuse to do that.
Mm-hmm.
We were going to be reflective in our actual staffing in terms of making sure that women's voices were heard, that people of color were being heard. And then in the front of the show, you know, the key is always comedy. I mean, comedy is what we're there to do. So you want to make it as funny and sharp as possible. And it's gallows humor. I mean, this is a dark time, and we need to reflect that, and we need to talk about some things and truths that,
yeah,
for some reason, you know, just are not attacked the way that I wish they were. I mean, I think Sarah Silverman does it. I think that, you know, South Park to some degree has done it. Like, I think there are people who are doing it, but the truth is it's a lot of regurgitation and not a lot of satire. I mean, I'm very proud of our guns episode with our "Now Is Not the Time" timepiece,
yeah,
bit, because, you know, that we should point out the farce of it. We should show how absurd this is. We should point out the absurdity of the lie that's told to us every day. And I think what's amazing is that we have transitioned into a place where forget Trump fatigue.
Yeah.
This is long before Trump. We all acclimated to just accepting lies.
Yeah.
I mean, how many Meet the Presses did I watch before Trump ever showed up on the scene, where everyone's stuff is all preset? You know what the interview's going to be. Chuck
mm-hmm.
Todd knows what he's going to ask you. And when someone does, and what passes for challenging now is like basic politeness. Back, you know, I mean, it's crazy to me what we consider a reporter challenging someone.
Yeah.
And I think that should show something about the sense of, you know, civility, which is a term of colonialism. You know,
mm-hmm.
So civility is the term that says you should keep it civil and don't step out of your box.
Yeah.
Right. That's why the term is civil disobedience.
Mm-hmm.
It's civil disobedience for the sake of we are breaking the civil rule. We're being disobedient against the order.
Yeah.
Are we doing it peacefully? Yes. And there are people who disagree on that point. I personally believe that ultimately peaceful protest will always achieve better results than violent overthrow or in violent action, because violent action leads to more response and ultimately ends in things that people don't think that abstractly they think they can handle, but in reality they can't.
Yeah.
And I think that's how we do it, is by layering the message in and just making sure it's funny. A little, you know, a lot of sugar so the medicine goes down.
Well, it seems to me a lot of it's got to be instinctive on your behalf. I mean, there's going back to your field pieces, I mean, the one that stands out, I think, above all else, well, maybe I think because it was the first one, is the field piece from the first episode with Keith Olbermann, and then where you're out, it's Trump's New York, and you end up on the, you know where I'm going, you end up on the stoop, and it turns into the Hong Kong Goes the Truck monologue,
yep,
which to me is one of the great highlights from the show, and also somehow you manage to weave it back into Donald Trump's personality and a comment on maybe how he views himself and how he views his place in the world, where he's a joyless man, it seems to me. And in that moment, you're not only commenting on his silliness with the truck, his childlike reaction to the appearance of the truck, but then you're also commenting on what exactly might be wrong with him at that moment at the same time. Tell me how that sequence came together with the truck specifically. Was that planned to have the truck, or was that pure improv? Did that happen just by accident?
That was pure improv. I was actually sitting and resting. We were about to finish. In fact, I think I said to them that we're done. And I sat down, and that was just me sort of, I said, oh, get a little bit of me, just Trump sitting here, right? And I thought that way we'd have B-roll in case we needed to cut to him resting or whatever. But I was just making the face, and then when the truck honked, I figured I was just sort of doing it for the crew.
Yeah.
Like, I knew we were filming, but I thought, oh, I'll just do this for everybody because it'll be funny. And so I you know, got up and started doing it, and they kept rolling, so I just kept going.
Mm-hmm.
And then I just improvised. I mean, that was all improvised. I didn't know there was a truck coming or any of that. And then, so I just improvised, I guess, you know, his fascination with trucks. I think I channeled probably a little bit of my own child there, you know, and how I was fascinated with trucks. And then I thought about a recurring dream I have about dropping into water and thinking I'm going to drown, and then I breathe, and then I realize that I can breathe in the water, and that's sort of a classic Jungian mother complex dream, and I believe he has a mother complex. So
yeah.
I thought, well, you know what? I'm just going to do this, but just sort of connect it to the truck, and I did that, and that was it.
Yeah.
I had no idea, never thought they would use it in the show.
Just absolute genius the way that ended up coming together. Just and you thankfully solved a bet for me, because I've been going since that aired. I've been telling people that is 100% pure improv, and that's why the show is genius, again, because you were able to turn a funny moment, a light moment with Trump sitting in the truck, or this in this case, you're commenting on the fact that a truck is passing by, with Trump's just rotting gray matter. It just seems like that is the centerpiece of the show, is just where you're able to almost subvert Trump from inside out. It's kind of a... it's an amazing dynamic to look at, where most of us are throwing knives and rhetorical attacks at Donald Trump. You're inside Donald Trump, pushing outward in a way. Is that an accurate read in terms of how you approach that as a character?
Yeah, well, I think it's partly also philosophical. That is how I approach him, is from the inside out, because that's how you learn a character. And so once you learn them, then you learn so many other things about them. And I also think, like, he's a surface-oriented insulter, right?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, the orange, the tiny hands, the Cheeto face, all that stuff. And, you know, we would do a joke here or there, like with the, he drew the turkey hand in the kids' piece and all that. You know, mm-hmm. we'd throw a joke in. But our general, you know, rule was inside out, you know, because that's the best way to get at him, is to go at the root part of who he is with where that he wants to hide. So I just thought, what are all the things he wants to hide? Where are all the vulnerabilities and all the things that he has constructed his personality around preventing showing people? And I'm just going to be the one that shows him without that governor. And by doing that, I'm always being able to hit him harder, because I know he knows that I know him.
Yeah.
Right?
Right.
So if he sees that, he knows that I got him pegged.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's a more effective tool. I tried to do this when I, you know, briefly went and spoke to the Clinton campaign in August, a couple of days in 2016. And they just, you know, were not ready to fully hear it. And they didn't take my advice in the debates.
Yeah.
But they should have, because the whole thing was, again, the whole argument of going, can you believe this guy? You know, I can't believe this guy is going to be president. You're missing the boat. That's already, you know, that's
a given.
That might happen. Yeah. And the fact that the Democratic Party hasn't even veered from that, that they're still basically, can you believe this guy? And it's like, well, you're going to lose again then, because maybe not in the midterms, but in 2020, if you can't give me more of an argument than anybody but him, that is not how people vote.
Yeah. Yeah, it's amazing.
People won't turn out.
It was amazing. You know? Chuck Schumer the other day tweeted at the president something along the lines of, how do you look at yourself in the mirror? Or just some facile, not even really an argument against Trump that is in no way. I mean, talk about a shot that's just going to ricochet off and not really make any damage. That was one of them.
Yeah.
It was just amazing
because,
to see that.
Listen, nobody wants to hear these other people of extreme privilege try to pretend as if they're really upset and shocked, right? When we all know at the end of the day that Chuck Schumer is not like the people who are banging on the Supreme Court doors.
Yeah.
And it's not, you know, and I'm not insulting Chuck Schumer. These people are just all entrenched, wealthy power brokers.
Mm-hmm.
And what they're doing, even if it is sincere, it's no longer able to come off sincere.
Yeah.
And the only way that they could do that would be to really put themselves at risk. But no one in the news media to politics, no one's willing to put themselves at risk.
Mm-hmm.
And the Trump knows that. And the Republicans know that. They know that no one's willing to take the leap and really put their money where their mouth is in terms of going at the larger problem of assessing and putting forward, maybe not to all the diehard Trumpers, but to enough of the reasonable people who might have felt they made a mistake, which you're only talking 60,000-70,000 people, that there is a better path and that will hear you. And I think one of the biggest problems is the divisiveness of social issues. I think it gets in the way of everything, and a woman's right to choose is such a fundamental value, and it's frightening to think that this is, we're entering an era where that might be emboldened, that type of thinking. And so I think that there's a real long haul that's going to happen if we don't, and especially if the Democratic establishment doesn't start, doesn't stop funding candidates that are just people who were former donors or former administration members, and actually puts their money behind maybe some rounds of losing candidates, but they're setting the groundwork for a larger, more diverse population of people running for office.
You know,
and the other part is young people have to come out and vote. Stop just tweeting about
shit. You know, and along those lines, Tony, there's one thing that I think Trump has going for him, strangely enough, and that's the fact that there's really no one else like him. He's kind of, he's an iconoclast in the worst ways possible. Do you ever worry about him producing an entire breed of copycats moving forward in Donald Trump's wake, like an entire series of Donald Trumps, like emerging through the giant Trump-sized hole in the wall, and exploiting that idea, the idea of Trump?
I mean, I think that Trump, I mean, listen, I think Trumpism, like many of his brands, I think that Trumpism will be like the sharper image of ideas. It's going to seem really glamorous for a little while, and then it's going to just disappear.
Well, I hope so.
And that's part of the special. I mean, I think part of the special is to say all things must pass.
Yeah.
And this too shall pass. But I think that, Trump is unique, and I'm going to say some things that might upset your listeners, but studying him and empathetically having to get in his head, there is a quality about him that's entertaining.
Yeah.
There are things that he says that are clearly sarcastic, and the media and Democrats will jump on it and be like, how could he say this? And it's like, come on, guys, it was a joke. I mean, he didn't mean it. Yes, is it beneath the presidency? Sure. But like, that's not the horse to get on, you know?
Yeah.
And the truth also is that this is a man who doesn't really care. Ultimately, he doesn't have an ideology. He doesn't have any, he's just doing whatever he thinks will win and get him attention.
Right.
So these other people who come out, who try to be like him, there might be a little wave where that happens, but you would have to have, whether people like it or not, he has a very strange charisma. And he has a charisma. And I know it's disgusting to say it, but he does.
Oh, it's totally true. Totally true.
And you know what? You can't duplicate that.
No.
You know, that's something you cannot duplicate, because this is a man who's bankrupted himself and all this stuff, and he's just stayed in the public eye, and that's partly because of his charisma. So these other people who copycat him, they'll just ultimately look like David Dukes and other white supremacy candidates, and they'll be too foul to elect. And, you know, the truth is that Trump's winning volley was walking up on that Republican stage in the first debate and going, I am corrupt. I have taken their money and I have paid them off.
Yeah.
I am part of the problem. I am part of the system. I don't think it was sincere. I don't think that he meant it that way, but it connected because it was a confession to everybody.
Yeah.
And the question is will there be the Democrat? And there was almost, Bernie was almost there, but they choked him out, man, because he would have had the opportunity to speak truth to the power of the party system. And the DLC, you know, the Democratic Leadership Council, something, I forget, the thing that took over when the Clintons took over in 92 must go away.
Yeah.
This notion of centrism and selling African Americans and women down the river just to get a little bit of economic push did not work. It didn't work.
No.
And I don't know why we keep following this thinking. I don't understand it. Well, and there's a bolder, better way to lead, and I don't get why people aren't doing it.
Going back to his charisma, you know, I've always said this. I wish the stakes weren't this high. I wish he wasn't so dangerous, because otherwise I would have a hell of a good time covering this presidency. It wasn't such a disaster and utter disaster waiting to happen. I've always said he's like a monkey with a machine gun. He's like, there's a viral video that goes around of a chimp carrying a machine gun and just suddenly starting mowing down people all around him. And that's the impression I get. It's this constant feeling as if we're leaning too far back in our chair. There's a great Stephen Wright joke where you're leaning too far back in your chair and you almost fall over, but you catch yourself at the last minute. I feel like that all the time. And so it seems like this would be a lot more fun if he wasn't so dangerous. But bringing him down to that personal level, I've noticed that he's just so, is he a psychotic kind of creature of habit? He does all kinds of things, and obviously this is your milieu, this is what you do. What is it about his behaviors? He does the same thing in certain settings every time. Like when he sits with his hands in that dick tent in front of him, leans way forward. He never has a solid center of gravity. When he's doing a cabinet meeting, he sits with his right hand on his left wrist. He does the same thing in the same ways every time. Is it his iconoclast nature? Is this just a weird old man who's set in his ways? What makes him do these same things over and over again?
I think he comes from an era where I think there's a little bit of thinking about how you present yourself as a man.
Yeah.
I think there's an OCD quality. I think he's performing himself and enjoys the performance. I think he witnesses himself performing. I think he's far, far more interested in himself and what he's doing and saying than what the outside world is projecting. But I also think you see a lot of self-soothing behavior, you know, how he touches his arms, when he crosses his arms, like during the Fire and Fury speech.
Yeah.
You know, there's sort of physical signals of like self-comforting, you know, I'm frightened, I don't like these things. He's, you know, Trump is very, he's great because he's such a perfect Jungian model. Mm-hmm. He has a strong ego construct that he has built, that he is selling the world, and his shadow is just constantly betraying him.
Yeah.
And I think he's just, it's fascinating that way. He's just such a fascinating self-betrayer.
Yeah.
And also, I mean, what does he do? He does the same things he did as a young man. He evicted people of color from Brooklyn and Queens apartment buildings with his father. Now he wants to evict people of color from the United States. He built buildings and all sorts of structures as a builder, supposedly, mostly just slapping his name on things. Now he wants to build a wall and doesn't even really build the wall, right?
Right.
He doesn't pay his fair share on taxes and has tons of suspicious activity reports with Cohen and banks in banking, and what does he do internationally? He pulls out of trade deals, screws people over, doesn't pay his bills. It's the same thing. There's the thing about him is that he's exactly the same. He does the same things. His instincts will always be the same.
Mm-hmm.
And there is, to me, very little surprise in what he does and how he behaves. And I think I'm actually always astonished at the fact that it takes people so long to catch up to.
Yeah, I've always said that Trump always makes things worse for Trump. I mean, what do you think is his fatal flaw? What is the personality flaw that he has that's ultimately going to take him down?
I think that that's a very good question. I think his sort of abandoned during the rallies.
Yeah.
I think that ultimately might take him down, and that I would translate that to his abandon in terms of making knee-jerk decisions.
Mm-hmm.
And my guess is that he will either do something that's such a gross violation of the Constitution or habeas corpus or rule of law that it will be beyond the pale for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that also if the blue wave hits, which I think it will, but I also think that everyone's been talking about a blue wave for so long, and again, it was another media narrative to create and gin up a bunch of attention, and people have to go vote to make that happen, and a blue wave happening does not save us all. But I think if that does happen, you're going to see the Republicans turn on him so quickly. I think that a lot of people who have been marching lockstep with him will start to turn away, because once he's weakened and he's no longer someone who has any sort of power or has the unchecked power of both houses of Congress, I think that it will change the dynamic greatly. And I think as he starts flailing more and more, he will ultimately step in something that will be that will ultimately truly be beyond the pale. I don't know if that's like choking out a child to death or you know, like, I assaulting, you know, Mitch McConnell's wife. Like, I don't know what it could be that will do that. But my guess is there'll be something he will do. And there's also, he likes to be all things to all people, and he wants to be liked ultimately by everyone. He wants to be loved.
Yeah.
So if the Democrats win the House, if he starts deciding, hey, it's in my best interest to make some deals with Democrats, he will then get abandoned on his side, and he will then have no oxygen on the other. But, you know, I think the fatal flaw is attention. If everyone pulled their attention away from him, he would wither and walk away, probably.
Yep.
I bet you he would just walk away. And it would be really great if Jack Dorsey would actually ban his personal Twitter account and just have his POTUS account so that these things are tweeted on the record as part of the White House record.
Oh, yeah.
And not allow him to have this private account. And I think that Jack Dorsey has a lot of explaining to do as a person that he allows his platform to be used as a tool of white supremacy, and that he is profiteering off of this madness while trying to act as if somehow he is out of control of his own company.
Yeah, yeah. And let me, you know, we only have a couple more minutes left here, Tony. Let me ask you something that, on a very serious note, we've seen a lot of personal confrontations in politics now, which I have some issues with, but that's beside the point. Do you ever get concerned? Have you ever worried about being confronted by some of Trump's red hats approaching you personally? Or has that ever happened, actually?
I mean, I have family members who are huge Trumpers.
Yeah.
And I have met Trump supporters on the road. And, you know, you get threats on Twitter that are nasty and so on. And But if someone comes at me, I mean, this is so trite, I guess, but, like, we're all just kids. I mean, we're all just grown-up kids.
Yeah.
And so what I try to do with a person who's a diehard Trump supporter is not look at them as some villainous idiot. I just try to look at them as a person who's in pain like anybody else.
Mm-hmm.
And I would, if they started yelling at me, I would listen to them, and then I would, you know, try to talk with them the best they can, and also tell them I understand that what I'm going to say to you isn't going to change your opinion.
Right.
You know, but I'm not afraid of that kind of confrontation. No, I mean that's the whole point of this whole thing, is for me to not just hear what I agree with.
Right.
And that doesn't mean that I think the other side I can necessarily agree with, but I don't. That doesn't mean I can't hear them out. You know, so no, that doesn't scare me.
Do you ever get so disgusted with him that you can't bring yourself to even to watch or satirize him?
I think the Blasey Ford thing was pretty disgusting. That was like a pretty gross moment. There's been a couple of gross moments where I'm just like, God, man, like, you really are just, like, disgusting.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's hard sometimes because but it's also the patheticness of it. I think it's the patheticness of his desire to keep upping the ante, to keep the attention on himself. And I think there, but for the grace of God, go I, you know, as a performer, you see the sort of emptiness of a person who doesn't know what to do with themselves without pure adulation and validation from others. You know,
tell me before we wrap up, tell me about the book. Tell me about American Tantrum.
American Tantrum, the Donald J. Trump Presidential Archive, comes out tomorrow. It's from HarperCollins. You can order it online at Amazon or go to your local bookstore and buy it. It is, we wrote this before the Michael Wolff book came out, and it's basically a collection. It's like meant to be both a narrative and a bathroom reader. So there's tons of, like, little phone calls, like Trump calls the space station, Trump calls Theresa May, you know, a lot of phone recordings. I was inspired by the Nixon tapes book. And then also these deep dive interviews with our fictitious author, Kelsey Nelson. And we follow Kelsey Nelson from being a country club Republican who sort of tacitly supports Trump to when Trump sort of basically cucks him with his wife. He becomes a proud boy and rejects his wife and becomes a diehard red hatter, then moves through that process and then comes out the other side. Maybe you'll have to read the book.
Oh my God.
We also have excerpts of Steve Bannon's Dan Brown style occult narrative, like, you know, novels that are sort of steeped in white supremacy. We have a variety of different, like, different writing pieces in there that are sort of a tribute to Americana. And I like to always say that it's basically part, you know, one part National Lampoon from the 70s and one part Thomas Paine's Common Sense. So it's a political document wrapped up in comedy. And we talk about 2020. We try to go a little further into the future. I think it's a really great read. Part, I mean, I wrote it with my friend Neil Casey, so of course we love it. But it's a great read because you can pick it up anywhere, or you can read it in its sort of totality and its narrative, and it's a really exciting book. And anyone who is in New York, they can come to the Barnes & Noble in Tribeca tomorrow at 6 p.m., and I'll be interviewed by Emmy Blotnick, the former head writer of my show, The President's Show, and now writer on the Colbert Report and great comedian in her own right. And then they'll be doing a book signing afterwards.
Do you have more specials? Is there going to be another special coming up at some point?
We don't know yet. The highway is officially sort of at the end, but hopefully, we'll find out. Everyone should watch the special, and then I'll have a much better chance at having something on television.
Outstanding. Well, Tony, you're doing such incredibly important work, and I hope you keep going. And good Lord, I hope maybe you'll consider doing another tour with James Adomian coming up in 2019, because I think Bernie's going to run again.
Well, James and I have already discussed it, and if the chips fall that way, then I can promise you that that will be happening. So,
well,
we'll be very excited about it. And thank you, Bob.
Thank you so much, Tony. Good luck tonight, and especially tomorrow with the book.
All right, brother. Great talking to you.
Take care. We'll see you around. Bye-bye. All right, this is why I love Tony's work so much. He's more than just a Trump voice with a funny wig. As I said a second ago, his work is deeply subversive and important now more than ever. Don't forget tonight, 11 p.m., The Fall of Donald Trump on Comedy Central. You're going to love this special, especially for the schadenfreude. Trust me on that. All right, coming up tomorrow, it's the usual Tuesday show with Buzz Burbank. Then we'll welcome The Washington Post's Greg Sargent on Wednesday, Jody Hamilton on Thursday, and the Friday after party with Kimberly A. Johnson on Friday, of course. Take it easy, folks. See you next time. Bye-bye.
A track. Oh, boy. Oh, boy. Oh, boy. Oh, boy. There we go. Yeah, honk, honk. Honk, honk goes the truck. Honk, honk goes the truck. Honk, honk goes the truck. Did you guys see? Honk, honk goes the truck. The truck goes honk, honk. Did you see that? Did you see it? Unbelievable. Did you see the truck? Did you see the truck go honk? It went honk and it moved so big. Unbelievable. It's so crazy. And you see how it moved, big trucks, big wheel, and the big wheels go around. And then when you pull on the horn goes crazy. And the truck's so unbelievable because it's from a tremendous truck. I wish we had a bigger truck. Wouldn't it be great if a big truck came? Like a big truck, big 18-wheeler truck, and it rolled down. And then a guy showed up, and he was a macho guy. And he says to me, "You drive the truck." And then I get to drive the truck. And I get to go all the way down, and I drive it right into the river. And then I drown in the river, and I feel the water seeping over me. And then the air leaves my lungs. And in the moment where my body starts to react and wants air, I let go. And when I let go, the water fills my lungs, and I'm finally at peace. And only then do I find the complete absolute solitude that I've wanted. Anyway, I want to go home, Bridget. I'm tired of this.
God damn it!